Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. One of the keys to containing the COVID-19 coronavirus is getting accurate information on how many people have contracted the virus. That's coming up in our first segment of today's program. I should tell you that today's broadcast is coming to you from the Lamar Home Studio, known up until this morning as my basement. And also coming up a little later in the program, COVID-19 separating fact from fiction. But up front, it will be difficult without information to reopen the economy and lift stay-at-home orders. Public health nurses are on the front lines of tracking the virus, and even though many may not be familiar with what they do, their roles are important. And we've learned the number of public health nurses have been cut. Joining us is journalist, Spotlight PA reporter, Aneri Patani. Aneri Patani, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Ms. Patani has reported for Spotlight PA, which partners with WITF's PA Post, on public health nurses and their role during the whole COVID-19 pandemic. Now, we still can take questions and comments. You can call us at 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Aneri Patani, what does a public health nurse or community health nurse, which is their official title, what do they do?
So it's a number of things, really. If you're talking generally, you know, pre-pandemic, one of their biggest responsibilities is to monitor and investigate reportable diseases. So if someone tests positive for tuberculosis, for measles, if there's a foodborne outbreak like salmonella, they also follow up on HIV and STD cases and about 70 other reportable diseases in the state. And basically what they do is try to figure out how did the individual get this disease, who else is at risk. You know, if someone has TB, they are going to call all the people who work in the same office as the individual, or they're going to go to the bar where that person was hanging out and make sure, you know, were there other individuals who could have contracted this, and how do we keep them safe? What do they need to follow? How do we connect people to treatment if needed? And then outside of that infectious disease work, they work on local community health needs, right? So they're located in different health centers across the state. So in some areas, they might be working with the community on clean water supplies and making sure well water is clean. In certain areas, they might be working on prevention of gun violence. It's sort of whatever the local community needs, that's where they tap in. Now, and then, of course, when we have outbreaks like right now or previously, you know, they ran the immunization clinics for swine flu. They monitored pregnant women during the Zika outbreak. So whenever there's an outbreak of some sort, they are sort of the front lines of responding to that.
Okay, so that brings up a point, something that you said in your answer. You said pre-pandemic. All right, so what are public health nurses doing, or what are their responsibilities during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, so now their focus is, you know, all COVID-19. That's their main responsibility. They do case investigation and contact tracing. So what that means is literally they have a system that every time a patient tests positive for COVID-19, it gets entered into the electronic surveillance system, and the nurses are meant to call each of them. And usually the individual knows they've already tested positive from their doctor or the lab, but the nurse's role is to tell them, you know, how to take self-isolation measures, to ask them about their symptoms, when they began, how they began, and most importantly, to ask them who else they've been in contact with over the last 2 weeks, and then give them information to relay to those people, because anyone who's been in contact with someone who's infected is at risk of being infected themselves, and they may not even know it. So getting that chain of information out there to individuals that, hey, you've been exposed, it's important for you to stay home so that you don't pass on the virus to others, is really important. And then so, in addition to that work, they're still doing, you know, all their normal stuff with TB patients or animal bites. None of that stuff goes away while they're also juggling this work.
See, I was wondering about that because you described so many responsibilities, and as we know, those other things don't go away, even though there have been numerous reports over the last couple of weeks about emergency rooms at hospitals, for example, seeing a lot fewer heart attacks or heart issues, and probably a lot of the issues that public health nurses are dealing with as well. But that role has changed since the beginning of the pandemic for public health nurses. Very early on, when they were getting information, they actually were seeing people physically. That's not the case now, right?
Yeah. So from speaking with some of the public health nurses and the Department of Health, it seems that early on they would deliver quarantine letters to the individual's home and get it signed that, you know, the person received this letter. And they were also, you know, as I mentioned, they were they're doing this contact tracing. Originally, they were calling each of the contacts too. So not only the person who tested positive, they were making the phone call to that person's coworkers, to that person's family members. Now what's happened is with the number of cases growing, they mail out the letters. They can't, you know, make home deliveries, and they actually can't call each of the contacts themselves. So what they're doing is they just call the person who tested positive, and they give them the information and say, you know, please pass this on to your coworkers, please pass this on to your family members, whoever you may have been in touch with.
You've described it pretty well, but I just wanted to clarify for our audience, what you're describing is contact tracing, correct?
Yes, that is it.
Okay, so everything that these public health nurses are doing, you know, is contact tracing. So how many public health nurses are there across the state?
So currently, the State Department of Health has 131 public health nurses. There are also a few, you know, counties and cities that have their own health departments that may employ maybe not nurses, but people doing similar contact tracing work. But at the state level, we're talking about 131 people.
So 131. That does not sound like a lot of people to, you know, we're over 40,000 cases here in Pennsylvania. That does not sound a lot like a lot of people to contact trace, to contact these people on the telephone or however they're doing it. Is that enough?
I mean, from any public health expert I've talked to, that's definitely not enough. You know, we're looking at, like I said, there are six counties and four cities in Pennsylvania that have their own local health departments. Otherwise, the 131 state public health nurses are responsible for 60% of the state. So roughly, that's like one nurse covering about 56,000 people. And so, you know, with the number of cases rising so quickly, they're definitely stretched thin. I mean, I spoke with nurses who were saying they work 6 to 7 days a week. Every week, they, you know, when they sign on in the morning, there are 200 cases on their screens that require them to make those calls and, you know, ask the individual about their symptoms, if they need to be connected to resources. Sometimes it's a person who, you know, doesn't speak English as their first language, and so they need a translator, and they're giving this information for the first time. So each call can take anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour, and they're doing these back to back to back. And so one of the nurses I spoke with told me, you know, even when I sign off at night, there are still 200 calls waiting to be made. So they're trying their best, but this is a huge task, and there's not enough of them.
20 minutes apiece, 200, and I think from your article that the reason there are 200 on the screen is that's all the screen holds, right?
Yes. So the system they have, I was told, basically at a time can only show 200. So when they log on, it's 200, but as soon as they mark one complete, for a lot of nurses, a new case just pops in at the bottom.
So how many hours are these public health nurses working?
Sounds like a lot. Honestly, I'm sure it varies by the individual nurse. A lot of the nurses I spoke with were saying, you know, they're working tons of overtime. They're working 6 to 7 days every week. Some of them even said to me, you know, hey, I want to talk to you for this piece, but I simply do not have the time. You know, I'm not quite sure when I'm going to sleep. I'm not quite sure when I'm going to spend time with my family again. This is sort of consuming them.
How backed up are they? Do you know?
I don't have a good number on that. I think, you know, a lot of the nurses are saying that they really are trying their best to get on top of this. And in terms of, you know, patients knowing that they tested positive, that information typically gets to them from the lab or from their own doctor. What's the missing component that the nurses are bringing that, you know, might be delayed if the nurses are delayed is that piece of what are the safety measures they need to take now and what information needs to be passed on to the individuals they came in contact with. Those are the pieces that the nurses get to them that, you know, kind of just depends on how quickly the nurses can make those calls and get that information out there.
The Associated Press has a story out today, a national story, about how individual states are contact tracing. Just want to give an example. In Pennsylvania, as Aneri said, there are 131 nurses that are doing this job. Now, a few health departments. But the state of North Dakota, which is not one of the more populated states in the country, has twice as many people tracing as we do here in Pennsylvania. So that provides a good example of how this is occurring. Want to talk about national coordination in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting live from my home today for the first time, and we'll continue broadcasting from here at the Lamar Studio, otherwise known as my basement, and while the pandemic continues. Our guest during this portion of the program is Spotlight PA reporter Aneri Patani. Spotlight PA is an independent, nonpartisan newsroom powered by the Philadelphia Inquirer in partnership with a number of media partners across the state, including WITF's PA Post, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Penn Live, The Patriot News. We're talking about Aneri Patani's story that ran this weekend, and there's a link to it on our website, WITF.org, and you also can see it at PA Post. Talking about the public health nurses that are contact tracing coronavirus cases across the state and how there are so few of them trying to do this job with over 40,000 cases. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Aneri, we received an email from Michelle, who asked a real good question. She says, I was reading today in the Washington Post about a critical care surgeon learning from his ICU team members in their daily check-in that they all were seeing COVID-19 patients with blood clotting. I was struck by the fact this critical new information was shared via one ICU team in their daily communications. Is critical new information being shared with all researchers, medical providers, and health departments in a coordinated fashion across the nation and throughout the world to ensure everyone has the most up-to-date information possible? If so, how is this being done?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. And, you know, to be quite frank, I think the answer is we don't truly know. I know, you know, we are seeing a lot of reporting that certain symptoms are identified in one country and then another, or, you know, one state is seeing a certain rate of infection or, you know, certain populations at higher risk than others. And I think a lot of states and countries and individual hospitals, individual researchers are racing to try to get this information. But generally, you know, in the U.S., there's not one public health infrastructure. There's not one system that ties all these places together. And so it's sort of a patchwork system, right, where if individuals have connections or if they have a centralized state reporting system that is gathering this information, it might work that way. But you know, generally, it's not set up as one national system. Each state does things very differently, and even within a state, you know, county and local departments can function differently.
And that would seem to be a problem. And maybe one of the lessons that will come out of this is that we do need some national coordination, because as it is right now, it is on a state-by-state basis. Aneri, history is important. Provide us with some background on the numbers of nurses and the funding over the years in Pennsylvania.
Right. So the fact that the nurses are understaffed and overwhelmed today, you know, certainly didn't happen overnight. This is a process that's been happening over the last 25 years at least. In talking to a lot of the nurses, they trace the first, big change in 1996 when the governor at the time tried to privatize the entire public health system. And he didn't succeed, but it still led to a loss of nursing jobs. And then we had a similar thing happen in 2013 where Governor Corbett at the time proposed closing half the state health centers and removing half the nursing positions. And so the nurses union sued to stop that. But of course, that process took a year to make its way through the courts. And even though the Supreme Court of the state ruled in favor of the nurses, a lot of the positions had already been cut by then. And then you come again to 2017 with Governor Wolf. He proposed cutting the budget for these state health centers where the public health nurses work by $13 million. And that did end up going through. He didn't close any centers or furlough nurses at this time. And they, have added to the budget a little bit since. But again, people leave in the interim. And what the nurses have said is anytime, there's an exodus of nurses, they're not refilling the position. So as of a week ago, the Department of Health told me they had 31 public health nurse vacancies. So 31 positions that aren't filled to begin with.
So any idea when you're talking about that history, why this was an area that was cut or at least proposed to be cut over the years?
Right. So typically it seems time and time again, right, the governors, the administrations will say they're trying to modernize the system and make it more efficient. They kind of focus on the fact that they want to close these buildings, and there's not often a lot of talk about how that comes with cutting nursing positions. But when I've been talking to the nurses, they will say it's because governments want to save money and they don't see the value of public health. And they say that's often because public health is a lot about prevention and it's hard to see, right? So when people are vaccinated and there is not a measles outbreak, an outbreak of measles, you don't see that. Or, when one person has tuberculosis and then they're successfully isolated so it doesn't spread to their coworkers, you're not going to read about that in the news. You don't read about the things that are prevented and don't happen. And that's where a lot of public health work lies. So the nurses say, the reason they're cut is because people don't understand what the benefits that they're providing are often invisible.
So unless we get in a situation like this, like a pandemic, or there's an outbreak of tuberculosis, which you don't see very often, or some of the other things that you described earlier that community health nurses do, they're kind of invisible, as you said, and government doesn't see that.
Exactly.
So we have a question from Amy in Hummelstown who asks, what's the training for these nurses? Are they truly nurses? What kind of professionals are these individuals?
Yes, these are all registered nurses, RNs. They're the same training that they could work in a hospital. They're the same degree. By working in public health, their focus is a little bit more on epidemiology and these large, one of the nurses described it to me as when you work in a hospital or a doctor's office, your patient is the individual who comes in. When you're a public health nurse working in one of these state health centers, your patient is the entire community. It's the town or the county in which you're in. And so you're not just looking at what made this one individual sick. You're looking at, well, is there a problem in the entire water supply that could be affecting everyone? Is everyone getting access to prenatal care so that, the next generation in this community is healthy? So sort of big picture questions like that.
Katie from Mechanicsburg asks, has the Department of Health considered utilizing school nurses for contact tracing?
I think this is a really important question. In speaking with several, public health and epidemiology experts, they raise the question of, is the state looking at retired public health nurses and bringing them back? Is it looking at other state employees? Is it looking at recruiting public health college students and professors to help with this work? As of now, the only information I have from the Department of Health is that they are working on a plan. Which could involve adding staffing or using technology to help contact tracing efforts, but they have not finalized anything yet. So while, a lot of other states have announced specifically how they are hiring more people or, if they're going to use school nurses or if they're, San Francisco is going to try to use librarians, all these different things, Pennsylvania hasn't announced any specifics yet.
And we have another email from Robert who asks, he says, Pennsylvania reports 40,000 COVID-19 cases, but truly the active number of cases is much smaller, as surely many have recovered. Do the county nurses get community nurses get accurate data that includes only active cases versus a case from 7 weeks ago that has now recovered?
I don't think I came across that specific question in my reporting. I know that, you know, the disease surveillance system they're using is updated constantly, right? When a lab tests a new case, the test results automatically, if they're positive, show up in the surveillance system that the nurses look at. So that is updated constantly. And I would presume they have a system of, you know, focusing on what is the most important or the newer cases. But in all honesty, I'm not sure how the details of that system work.
By the way, Lisa Wardle, who is WITF's social media director, has been answering a lot of these questions that we get from listeners. And she just sent this, the question I asked earlier, Anari, about how information is coordinated throughout the country. She says information is shared through multiple steps. Doctors report to hospitals, which report to their State Department of Health, which reports to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But the U.S. fragmented system does not require hospitals to share granular data, such as each patient's symptoms, nor is there a tool or process in place for that type of information to be shared broadly. We're still learning about the coronavirus, and new information may be coming from all ends of the chain. Keep in mind that what one hospital experiences may not be the same at another hospital. The most reliable information will come from peer-reviewed research on the virus. The New England Journal of Health is well-regarded in the healthcare community. So thank you, Lisa, for providing that information. Mike from Cumberland County asks, why can't anyone volunteer to do contact tracing? What training is needed? People out of work, this could be an opportunity for them.
Absolutely. I think that's something that I've heard from experts as well, that generally, you know, contact tracing in terms of, you know, calling the individuals, people who've come in contact with a person who's tested positive and just letting them know how to quarantine can be done. You know, you don't require a particular degree to do that. When it comes to knowing who the person who tested positive is, that typically has to be a state employee because that's, personally identifiable medical information. But a lot of states are turning to either volunteers or, you know, hiring individuals without this experience and giving them, you know, contact tracing training. I know Massachusetts is one of the big places that is doing this. They are partnering with a nonprofit to hire about 1,000 contact tracers and just give them the, you know, just-in-time training so that they can start doing this work. Pennsylvania has not announced a process like this yet. I know one of the House representatives, Representative Frankel, is considering introducing a bill to help hire more contact tracers, which would be, you know, could be individuals who are out of work right now and want to help with this important response. But that hasn't really made its way into any legislation yet.
Julia asks, for years we have heard about a nursing shortage in healthcare. Do you think that this pandemic will encourage young people to go into nursing or some sort of frontline healthcare work or deter them?
I think that'll be really interesting to see. I know in speaking with some of the nurses, they are hopeful, you know, that when there is a pandemic, right, their work is often so invisible. And right now it is glaringly visible, you know, what they do, why it's important, both public health nurses and, you know, clinical nurses in hospitals. So I think, you know, we might see an increase if people are really, you know, starting to learn more about these roles and why they're important in society. But of course, it's hard to predict.
We have another email here. Says, my mom was a community health nurse. She spent a great deal of time on the road visiting homes and in communities and in migrant housing areas. They are unsung heroes on a normal day. Now they are warriors with an enormous workload and they are paid a pittance. What about pay? Are they how are they paid when it comes? I mean, are they making a decent salary or what?
Yeah, so based on the state's payroll data that I was able to look at, community health nurses earn between $57,000 to $87,000 annually. And the Department of Health has said, you know, one of the reasons they have difficulty filling the vacancies is because the salaries they offer are well below the private sector nursing. So it's hard to attract people to these positions.
Why is the role of public health nurses important to reopening Pennsylvania? What will the consequences be of not having enough of them as we move forward?
Yeah, so this is really the key from all the public health experts I've spoken with and even the national conversation, right? We have to be able to have both testing and contact tracing capability as we reopen. If we find out who is sick, identify them, identify the people that they could have passed the virus on to, then we can quarantine, you know, just those individuals and work on containing the virus. So that other people can, you know, start going to work or going to school in the long term. And this is a model that we've seen work in other countries, right? South Korea, Taiwan, Iceland, several others that have large public health workforces have been able to do this. But if we can't, right, if we can't know who is exposed and or who has the virus and who has been exposed to individuals with the virus, then it's really hard to prevent another outbreak in the future and another potential round of shutdown orders. So it's definitely one of the key pieces to reopening the state, and I think that's why a lot of localities, a lot of states are looking at contact tracing as, you know, vital to moving forward.
I'm curious, Aneri, when we talk about across the state, now granted, these nurses are making their contacts now via telephone, but I would think that there are fewer of them in rural areas where there are fewer healthcare facilities available. Is that an issue at all?
Yeah, so there are certainly fewer of them in rural areas. And of course, you know, from the Department of Health, they'll say, you know, we staff based on population and there's a greater need for more nurses in, for example, you know, southeastern Pennsylvania than there is in the northwestern part of the state. But in talking to a lot of public health nurses, what has happened is there used to be, you know, a public health nurse in most counties, and now some of those counties don't have any at all. And so it's one nurse trying to cover, for example, Forest County and Jefferson County and Venango County or something to that effect. So there is someone who's, you know, supposed to be looking at those areas, but of course, you know, it's one individual doing what used to be done by three individuals or something to that effect. And so they're, you know, one person taking on a lot more than is one person's job typically.
See, that would seem to be a bit of an issue when you're talking about reopening, because as Governor Wolf announced last week, we will be doing this regionally as far as opening up areas. And he mentioned the north central part of the state, northwestern part of the state that have the fewest cases right now per 1,000 or 10,000, I think it is. But anyway, if public health nurses haven't contacted people, as many people in those areas, is it wise to, well, maybe I shouldn't ask it, is it wise, but are we getting accurate information is, I guess, the better way to ask the question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is one of the concerns from the nurses. One of the things that the state can and does do is, you know, ask nurses in different parts of the state if they are overwhelmed or, you know, can to help investigate cases in other areas. But typically what happens with that is, you know, if southeastern Pennsylvania has a lot of cases, nurses in the Northwest will, you know, end up making phone calls for the Southeast as well. It's not typically the other way around. So when we are talking about, you know, rural counties, there is the possibility that other nurses in other parts of the state could help them. But that's not typically how it happens from my understanding with the nurses. So, you know, we asked Governor Wolf and Secretary Levine if they would allow different parts of the state to reopen without boosting this public health workforce, without hiring more contact tracers. And essentially, you know, they said they're looking at hiring more people and contact tracing is part of the conversation when it comes to reopening, but the specifics of it are really unclear.
So, Aneri, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. You know, this is a really valuable story that that you've done. And again, our listeners, if they haven't read it over the weekend, can see it on WITF.org/smarttalk. We have a link to it also at PAPost.org. So what's the takeaway How did this story develop, and what's the takeaway that you have?
Yeah, so I mean, this started with, in all honesty, when I started the story, I didn't know what public health nurses were, what they did. The story started with a simple question of, you know, contact tracing is important. We're hearing that from lots of experts. Who does that in Pennsylvania, and how's it going so far? And I think what I've learned is, you know, public health nurses are doing this work not just, you know, right now for the coronavirus. They do this type of work for all sorts of reportable diseases and infectious diseases that we don't want to see spread. And, you know, over the years, public health has been underfunded and understaffed in Pennsylvania. And while, you know, no one has said that would, you know, staffing would have prevented this virus by any means, it may have changed the ability to respond to it.
Spotlight PA reporter Aneri Patani. Aneri, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
For more information on coronavirus, COVID-19, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting live for the first time today from the Lamar Home Studio, otherwise known as my basement. We'll continue broadcasting from home on Smart Talk for the foreseeable future, at least until the pandemic ends or it's a lot safer to venture outside. We are trying our best, even at WITF, the Public Media Center, to have as few people in the building as possible. Scientists around the globe are working at a frenetic pace to try and understand, treat, and prevent the coronavirus, a novel virus with few treatment options. Even though it is a new virus to medical researchers, it does have some similarities to other viruses. Where facts are missing, there is plenty of speculation about COVID-19 all over the internet. With limited and developing factual information known about the virus, it is often hard to discern between what is truth and what is fiction. Our guest today has done just that at Susquehanna University. Dr. Tammy Tobin is professor and chair of the Department of Biology at Susquehanna University. She has a presentation called Understanding COVID-19, Separating Fact from Fiction. Dr. Tobin, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be on your program today.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Dr. Tobin, how did this presentation, Separating Fact from Fiction on COVID-19, how did it come to be?
We have a fairly active alumni education program at Susquehanna, and the director of that program, Dr. Nick Clark, asked me about a month ago whether I would feel comfortable presenting something on COVID-19 for our alumni, and I thought about it and decided that I could do that. I do teach our virology class, so I felt comfortable in my background knowledge in viruses in general to be able to put this talk together for our alumni, and then it sort of spread out. Faculty, staff, and students also joined in. So we had that presentation on Thursday.
So what is the biggest myth about COVID-19?
Oh, there are so many. I think that I don't know if there's one biggest myth, to be honest. I think because of the way we are doing, the way scientists are doing their research with COVID-19, keeping it so open and transparent. They're providing results of research before formal publication. And so I think the biggest thing that's happening right now is people tend to latch on to very preliminary studies, unpublished studies, and sort of ride with those a little bit more than they ought to before the science really has nailed down what's going on. And so that has ranges from where the virus comes from, what the virus infects, what drugs are going to ultimately and treatments are going to be effective, all of those things.
Well, you mentioned in your presentation, to provide some context, that 5 months ago, we didn't even know this virus existed. Now, you also mentioned that you have done a lot of research and have a lot of background knowledge when it comes to SARS, for example. So, you know, it is very unusual that in real time we are hearing speculation about what works, what doesn't, what it is, where it's come from, all those things. And with social media today, word spreads so fast, and it's just amazing that how much information is out there. I mean, when the president of the United States says last week about using Lysol, maybe it can be injected, and there are people who actually think about it, a good example of, you know, how people are latching on to almost any kind of information that they get.
Sure, that's right. And I think that's, I can understand why that would be. I mean, this is really scary. It's disrupted all of our lives. At Susquehanna, we went away for spring break in the first week of March, and we never came back. And we've been teaching and working online with our students since that time. Other people are, many millions of people are completely out of work right now. And so people want to know and you know, really, really want to be able to do something. They want a treatment. They want something that's going to work. And so it is not surprising that folks would just latch on to something like that. Although I suspect it's less common for people to think they ought to use Lysol than it is for them to think they ought to use something like hydroxychloroquine or something along those lines. But you can understand why people would really be very desperate for news and for good news.
We have a listener, Anne, who has a question for you, wants to know if Dr. Tobin is aware of a good website for verifying accurate medical information around COVID-19. Is Snopes, for example, staying up to date on medical rumors?
So there are actually really lots of good sites. If you want to know what really is and is not approved for anything, and by the way, there aren't any. The Food and Drug Administration has sites where you can look at what clinical trials are going on and what is really being studied. I would suggest that the Food and Drug Administration is a great place to go to see the status of treatments if you're interested in that. And then, honestly, the Centers for Disease Control, the World Health Organization, state and local health departments all have up-to-date information about what is and is not being recommended with regards to keeping yourselves safe. Currently, there isn't an FDA-approved treatment for COVID-19, but there are lots and lots of drugs that are being tried in both compassionate care and in clinical trials. Those are moving along pretty quickly. The same thing is true for any trials being done with vaccinations and the current status of antibody testing. So to know really where everything is at, FDA is a good place, and as well as those national, world, and local health organizations.
You know, Dr. Tobin, though, I'm picturing social media, and we know that there's a partisan divide. A lot of people who are suspicious of what they hear from the government, that has created, and this is a good example during this time, has created a real problem that maybe we haven't experienced in the past to this degree of that distrust of government, that there may be people who may not trust what they get from the CDC or the FDA. Who are they going to trust if that be the case?
Most people trust their own doctors. So I would say that those individuals, their own healthcare providers are great sources of information. I would suggest trying to just get in there and read for themselves. And so even if somebody is getting their information from social media or from online news or any of those sources, they can go to their favorite news source, and most of those have links to where that information really came from. And so if somebody is distrustful of the government or distrustful of science or Which is hard for me as a scientist to grasp.
I understand.
But I get that. I have relatives too, and I think that it is important for people not to just stop at the level of social media, right? Just to read that and say, well, okay, that's it then. You know, really dig down. If you don't trust the information you're getting, then I think it's really important for people to find where those studies came from and understand that there's a difference between somebody just saying something and something that's actually being tested for its safety on humans.
So let's talk about a few of the myths that we've heard or some of the things out there. Where did the coronavirus actually start? I mean, we know it started in China, but where and how?
It did. The coronavirus actually started in the horseshoe bat in China. These are actually many coronaviruses that have ended up in humans over the years have started in bats. And the reason that we know this is that you can actually, and scientists do, sequence the entire genome, the genetic information of the human current SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19, and they compare that to the hundreds of other types of coronaviruses that exist out there in nature, and the very closest match that they got, about a 90% match, was to this horseshoe bat. It is also this bat that in which the original SARS came from. So this thing originated in bats in China. There are no other sequences that we've looked at so far that match as closely as that bat.
There seems to be good evidence that China wasn't as forthcoming with information as they could have been when it comes to the beginning of this outbreak. But can China be blamed for this, or is it something that maybe they even didn't realize what they were looking at?
Yeah, so I think it is correct to say that China is not always particularly forthcoming with information, even scientific information, but I don't know that you can blame somebody for a viral outbreak. To be quite honest, this is a brand new virus. It's a brand new type of coronavirus that I don't think anybody could have seen coming, and particularly given what we now know about asymptomatic, you know, individuals can be asymptomatic for a while, and quite viremic, quite capable of transmitting this virus before they show any symptoms. And so I think that that China was caught just as off balance as all the rest of us have been. You know, we expected to be able to see sick people and to isolate them and to keep it from spreading. And in fact, we didn't see all of the people who were carrying the virus. Probably we missed lots and lots of them. So I don't think it's fair to blame China for this one.
Over the weekend, and over the past week, actually, almost everywhere that you are in public, if you are in public, you do see people wearing masks. Governor Wolf has asked that we wear a mask when we are out in public. But one of the myths is that masks don't help. Talk about that myth.
Sure. Okay, so I think that myth originated early on in simply because healthcare officials weren't necessarily recommending wearing masks early on. What a mask does, I'm going to back up another step. One of the major ways in which COVID-19 is passed from person to person is by exhaling water droplets. And those water droplets in an infected person can be laden with viruses. And so they end up going into the environment around them. If you're standing too close, they hit you in the face. They drop down onto surfaces, cell phones, tables. I'm sitting in front of my computer keyboard right now. I'm literally raining down on my environment. And if I'm infected by that virus, those water droplets will carry that virus with them. And then the next person who comes along will touch that surface with their hands. And if they don't wash their hands soon enough, they can then contaminate themselves. Or if they're standing within 6 feet, they're literally getting rained on by these water droplets that have viruses. So the mask keeps you from, it stops the water droplets. And it keeps those water droplets from getting out into the environment. So masks don't directly keep the wearer from being infected. And healthcare providers have been really clear on that all along. You can still get those droplets in your eyes if the person across from you is not wearing a mask. And so it's an indirect protection. You wear a mask to protect the people around you, and they wear a mask to protect you. That's how that works.
Well, what created some confusion with mask is that very early on we were told masks do no good, when really what they were talking about, because they were only looking at it from one direction, is that it wouldn't keep you necessarily from getting the virus, but it would keep you, what we learned along the way, it would keep it from spreading, as you just described.
That's correct.
But that's what created some confusion.
Another one
that we hear is that warm weather. I don't know when it's going to get warm here in the Northeast, but that with the coming of spring and warm weather, like the flu, maybe that the coronavirus wouldn't spread as quickly or wouldn't spread. What about that?
We have no way of knowing, actually, at this point. As you pointed out, we really haven't had summer yet. So we don't know if here in the United States or elsewhere in the world, if it's going to slow the spread. But it certainly has spread pretty effectively in some warmer areas. And so I don't think it's going to be less infectious in warmer weather. It may not spread as readily. We, as individuals, at least in colder climates, tend to get outside more often and stay 6 feet apart a little bit more naturally than we do in the colder weather. But at this point in time, I don't think you can speculate on whether or not this is going to go away like the flu, or if it's going to maintain throughout the warmer months as well.
You mentioned earlier, we talked a little bit about partisan views and politics. We have a listener who asked, as I understand it, peer review is essential for science to come to a consensus regarding prodigy shifts over time. Is there a political side to the information that's published within the scientific community?
In an ideal world, no. The way that a peer review works is that somebody will submit an article for publication, and that goes out to a panel of scientists. And they really look at the data. They're looking to poke holes in it. Is there something flawed about the experimental design? Is there something flawed about the way that person has analyzed the data, the conclusions that they've come to? And it's only after that group of reviewers has said, yeah, this is ready for prime time, really, that this seems to be a solid paper, that it moves forward. Now, I think it would be a mistake to say that there aren't some politics in science, but I don't think we're talking about Democrat-Republican politics here. People know each other, and that can influence, in a poorly controlled peer review, how things are reviewed. But in terms of something coming out that's conservative or liberal or Democrat or Republican, those types of politics really don't play a role in peer review. It's really about the science. And so I can't see a situation where somebody would say, well, you know, this is something that the Democrats have really loved and it's more likely to get published, or that the Republicans really love and it's more likely to be published. That I don't see happening in a peer review situation.
Another myth, and we only have about a minute and a half left, but that this is nothing more than just a bad flu, and that it will follow the path of a typical influenza. What about that?
First of all, it's not influenza; it's coronavirus. And there's a big difference between what happens yearly with influenza and what is happening with coronavirus right now, and that is that we're simply not immune, and we don't have vaccines, and we don't have effective drugs. And so, you know, in the long term, will this become something seasonal that we just deal with every season like we do the flu? Perhaps. I'm hopeful that it might be more like the measles, right? We get a vaccine and it lasts for a good long time. But this is not like a flu. We don't have any residual immunity from earlier infections. It's a naive population, and so you know people are that when they get exposed, they are much more readily infected and much more likely to have severe disease because they're just we don't have the vaccine, so we don't have the treatment.
Dr. Tammy Tobin is professor and chair of the Department of Biology at Susquehanna University. Her presentation is Understanding COVID-19, Separating Fact from Fiction. Dr. Tobin, thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, Right to Repair, that Right to Repair bill that we talked about earlier this year takes on a new importance because of ventilators. So tune in to tomorrow's program. We'll be coming to you from the Lamar basement tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.